Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly and I will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Tim Wirtz Jr. looked at two large rainbow trout swimming near land. He cast his fishing line into the water. No luck. The fish swam right past, not even stopping for a look. Wirtz did not seem to mind his failure at fishing. At a time when millions of Americans are following stay-at-home orders, he was out enjoying the weather, all while obeying guidelines for social distancing. He made sure not to get within 2 meters of other people. Wirtz's father, Tim, approved of his son's activity. It's a good way to get out in the fresh air, and he can still distance pretty easily, he said. The coronavirus health crisis has pressed many Americans into their homes. For some, the only escapes are trips to buy food, visits to the doctor's office, and trips to open spaces for physical exercise. A visit to the neighborhood lake with a fishing pole in hand has become a popular get-out-of-the-house activity. Across the United States, many bodies of water are closed to the general public, but many community lakes are open and have fish. Steve Gerton is Community Fishing Program Manager for Arizona Game and Fish. Gerton says that although he did not have exact information, we've definitely seen a lot of anglers out. We're seeing a lot more people trying to get outdoors. Anglers are a kind of fishermen. They use a fishing line and rod to catch fish, not a net. The appeal of fishing is clear. Fishing is mostly an activity for one person or a small number of people. And what about those social distancing guidelines? They are already in place. Stephanie Vatalaro is with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. You don't want to be close, she said. You're going to tangle your lines. Get your equipment mixed up. Fishing is a sport that lends itself to social distancing, for sure. The Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation was created to increase Americans' interest in boating and fishing. The group's website, takemefishing.org, has seen a 15% increase in traffic over the past month. Online searches for fishing and how to fish information have increased by over 300%, notes the Associated Press. Searches for fishing licenses are at the highest point in 4 years. A recent Harris poll showed 24% of people with children under 18 were thinking about fishing more during the coronavirus pandemic. Fatalaro said that fishing helps people in many ways. It's great for mental health, stress relief, connecting with your family, creating memories. But health and safety is number one. I'm John Russell.
As the new coronavirus spread in March, Ada Limon struggled at first to write. The American poet said she felt flattened and silenced by a pandemic that had shut down much of the world she knew. I could call nothing to me. I'd think of a sound, a word, a subject, and it was all failing, she told the Associated Press. I would look at my own poems and think that even their subject that I was tied to still felt distant to me. By April, she had found inspiration to write. What she wrote was far from a traditional poem. Instead, it was a list of what she felt was no longer within her reach. Limon ended the poem with a cry, "I am asking you to touch me." She named it The End of Poetry. I didn't know what it was going to do, but it felt a great relief to list things that I could no longer access, she said. Limon's poem is among more than 80 works included in a collection called Together in a Sudden Strangeness. The anthology will be available as an e-book on June 9th and as a hardcover book in November. The anthology's name comes from Chilean poet Pablo Neruda's work, Keeping Quiet. The poem includes the lines, "We would all be together in a sudden strangeness." Alice Quinn is a former poetry editor with Alfred A. Knopf Publishing House and New Yorker magazine. She collected works for the book. Poets have always been those we turn to as witnesses, she said. Poets can crystallize a moment like this. Book writers will likely take months or years to fully examine the pandemic and its effects and put their thoughts into words. But the art of poetry has an immediacy to it that makes creation possible in the middle of a historical period. At least one well-known poet, Julia Guez, is known to have the coronavirus. A poem of hers is included in the collection. It is called, "If Indeed I Am Ill, Brother." Together in a Sudden Strangeness also includes works from poets who are doctors, such as Amit Majmudar's An American Nurse Foresees Her Death. The collection has poems about loneliness and grief, and one on becoming a parent during a time of social distancing. The book also includes a work from Major Jackson, a prize-winning poet based in Vermont. Jackson says many poets he knows have had difficulty writing during the pandemic. He says they feel guilty because of the anxiety they express, as if they are less of a poet. Jackson said he and his wife, poet Didi Jackson, told themselves they would write every day once they began sheltering in place. His poem, Invocation, is a call for better times and for a renewal of old times. It reads, "We want the father in the park running behind a child pedaling into her future. We want to turn a corner and stumble upon the muted concert of two men in an embrace with entangled eyes. We want to hear a faraway train whistle cast a spell on the coming night."
Thank you. A new study predicts that in just 50 years, as many as 3.5 billion people could be facing near unlivable heat. The extreme heat would be a result of rising world temperatures linked to human-made climate change, the study suggests. Researchers from the United States, China, and Europe were involved in the study. The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reported the results. Martin Scheffer is an ecologist at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. He helped lead the research. He said the research shows that historically, human populations have mostly lived in areas where the average yearly temperature was between 11 to 15 degrees Celsius. A smaller number lived where the average temperature was higher, between 20 to 25 degrees. Scheffer said that since these population centers have existed for several thousand years, it suggests the areas represent a climate niche necessary for human survival. But if world temperatures keep rising, this could put large parts of the population in areas too warm to live in without cooling technology, Scheffer and his team reported. The exact number of people who could be put at risk depends on whether pollutant levels of heat-trapping carbon dioxide can be reduced and how fast the world population will grow. Under the worst-case predictions for population growth and carbon pollution, the study estimates about 3.5 billion people could be living in extremely hot areas by 2070. That would be one-third of the world's projected population. Even predictions considered by some scientists to be more likely estimate at least 2 billion people will be living in places too hot to survive without air conditioning in 2070, the study found. It's a huge amount and it's a short time. This is why we're worried, Cornell University climate scientist Natalie Mahowalt told the Associated Press. She was not part of the study. But she and other outside scientists say the research makes sense and presents the urgency of man-made climate change differently than past studies. The new study used an unusual method to identify the climate niches the research is based on. A team of international scientists studied humans like they do bears, birds, and bees to find the areas where human populations live and thrive. The researchers looked back 6,000 years to create the niche areas. Currently, about 20 million people live in places with an average yearly temperature greater than 29 degrees Celsius. The areas make up less than 1% of Earth's land and mostly near the Sahara Desert. But as the world gets warmer and more crowded, the study predicts that large areas of Africa, Asia, South America, and Australia will also likely be in the same temperature range. Study co-writer Chur Shu of China's Nanjing University predicts that well over 1 billion people will be affected, possibly billions more. but he and other researchers noted there is still time for humans to make climate-changing action to slow Earth's warming. Martin Scheffer said in a statement, the study's predictions would mean unlivable conditions for the ordinary, for poor people, for the average world citizen. He said such conditions could lead to major climate migrations from the hottest areas of the world. Tim Lenton is a climate scientist and director of the Global Systems Institute at Britain's University of Exeter. He helped lead the research. Lenton said countries like Nigeria, with a population expected to grow 300% by the end of the century, would likely face major difficulties if the predicted warmer conditions develop. I'm Brian Lynn.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov. And now we present The Making of a Nation. Today, Kelly Jean Kelly and I continue the story of the presidency of Barack Obama. Conflicts related to race happened throughout Obama's time in office. Early in his first term, police arrested a Harvard University professor in his own home because they believed he was breaking into the house. The professor was an African-American man. Obama commented publicly on the arrest, saying the police had acted stupidly. He added, "There's a long history in this country of African-Americans and Latinos being stopped by law enforcement more than was fair." Obama's words made some police officers and other Americans angry. The public reaction showed that while the country had elected an African-American president, race was still a sensitive issue.
2 years later, racial tensions exploded over the shooting of a 17-year-old African-American named Trayvon Martin. He was walking in a Florida neighborhood when a leader of the local neighborhood watch group shot him, claiming self-defense. The shooter was tried and found not guilty of a crime. But many Americans believed the case showed that African Americans were unfairly treated. In answer, Obama called for the country to come together. He spoke about Martin's parents, noting that he was raising two children.
You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And, you know, I think they are right to expect that all of us, as Americans, are going to take this with the seriousness it deserves and that we're going to get to the bottom of exactly what happened.
Yet, the nation was facing racial conflict again soon. In 2014, a police officer killed another unarmed African-American teenager. Michael Brown was suspected of robbing a store in Ferguson, Missouri. The shooting led to weeks of protests in Ferguson, some of them violent. Later, a jury ruled that the officer had not committed a crime. But the federal government found that the city's police and court system had a history of race-related abuses. Feelings about Ferguson were still high when, in June 2015, a white man shot and killed 9 African Americans at a prayer meeting in Charleston, South Carolina. The shooter was clear that he targeted the victims because of their race. In the days that followed, Obama traveled to Charleston and met with the families of the victims. Historian Michael Nelson remembered him speaking at the funeral of the clergyman killed in the attack.
In addition to the words he spoke, I started singing.
Amazing grace.
The old hymn, which, by the way, is a hymn in black churches and white churches, Amazing Grace. That's something that presidents don't usually do, but it really did sort of connect with the moment. It's an affirmation of, you know, as bad as things are, they will get better, or they can get better if we recommit ourselves.
Yet, as historian Michael Nelson notes, it is one thing to meet people's emotional needs and another to make political changes. Obama did not succeed in persuading Congress to pass national gun control reforms. His most serious effort came after a mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012. 20 young children and 6 adults died in the attack. The shooter was a 21-year-old man with mental health problems, an interest in violence, and the legal right to use a gun. He had no apparent reason to target the school or the children. Obama spoke out emotionally after the shooting.
Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad.
But a majority of lawmakers and many Americans did not think the federal government should, or even could, limit the right to own guns.
In his presidency, Obama and his administration expanded health care for Americans. Working with administration officials, Congress developed and later approved a bill to help people who could not pay for health insurance. It set up a system so that the federal government would pay for some of the cost. It also required insurance companies to help people who were already sick. Under the measure, insurance plans for parents would pay health care costs for their children until they reached age 26. President Obama signed the bill into law, but his administration's efforts were not popular with everyone. Critics objected that the law sharply increased government involvement in American society. Historian Michael Nelson says some people disliked the measure so much that they called the law Obamacare in order to blame the president for it.
Obama later said, I'm fine with that, because that extended the protection of health insurance to many Americans who otherwise didn't have it or were in jeopardy of losing it. I think, you know, Obamacare has become now kind of part of the fabric of American national life. And the fact that his name is attached to it means that people will always associate that with him.
Obama was able to pass health care reforms because his party, the Democrats, won control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate in the 2008 elections. 2 years later, as a sign that his policies were not popular with many Americans, the Democrats lost control of the House. Obama noted the defeats. He said after the 2010 elections that the Democrats took a shellacking. 4 years later, the party also lost control of the Senate. As president, Obama took steps he believed were needed to make all Americans equal under the law. In 2012, he expressed support for same-sex marriage. 2 years later, Obama signed an executive order to protect the rights of LGBT employees in the workplace. LGBT is short for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual. Many Americans opposed the president's policies on social questions. On international issues, Obama and his government faced challenges in Libya, Syria, and with Russia. And he was both supported and criticized for supporting the Paris Climate Agreement, a deal designed to slow rising temperatures. Obama was also criticized for agreeing to a nuclear deal with Iran. For years, Iran claimed its nuclear program was only for peaceful purposes. Yet the United States and other countries were not so sure. Under the 2015 agreement, the Iranian government promised to limit its nuclear activities and permit visits by international inspectors. In exchange, world powers agreed to ease economic actions against Iran.
Without the support of lawmakers, in his last months in office, Obama used executive orders to carry out policies. The actions have the force of law at the time, but they can be easily overturned by future presidents. Some Americans took aim at Obama personally. They questioned whether he was even born in the United States. A businessman led a call for Obama to release documents proving where he had been born. That man was Donald Trump. As Obama's time in office was coming to an end, Trump announced he would run for president himself. And in November 2016, he took the White House.
That brings our history series to a close for now. Thank you for joining us for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.